We are ready tonight to get into the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation. The 17th chapter basically dealt with the fall of Rome, called Babylon, in that chapter. The 18th chapter sort of restates that and shows the results of some of the things that happened. The 19th chapter then particularly emphasizes Christ and the marriage supper of his wife, and also the end of the beast and the false prophet. Now, if you go back to chapters 12 and 13, we had introduced there three terrible beings: the dragon, the sea beast, and the land beast. And the dragon was identified in the scripture as being the devil. And in our study and the approach that we're taking, we identified the sea beast as the Roman emperor and the land beast as the religious leader. It said that he was the one that got people to worship the other beast, and so that fits the religious leader. And then when we get over to the 19th chapter and verse 20, the beast was taken and with him the false prophet. Instead of having the sea beast and the land beast, at this point they're called the beast and the false prophet. Now, the woman that's in chapter 17, I think basically is referring to the Roman Empire, the city of Rome and all associated with it, because it says the woman sat on seven hills, you remember, and on many nations and many waters, and the waters were identified as many people. And so with the fall of Babylon, in a figurative sense, in chapter 17, and then the fall of the beast and the false prophet here, we have the fall of the city, the empire, and the fall of the emperor, who had encouraged people to worship him and look at him as God, and the fall of the false prophet, who would have been the religious leader in Rome, causing people to worship the beast, and if not, then, or if they did, to get the mark of the beast that we have studied. Now, with the three, the dragon, the false prophet, and the beast, we see that the beast and the false prophet are cast alive into a lake burning fire with brimstone. And that signifies the end of them. Now, when we get into the 20th chapter, we're going to see the end of the devil. But the devil didn't cease to exist when Rome fell, did he? And he didn't cease to exist when the emperor fell. He didn't cease to exist when the false prophet fell. So there are going to be several things happen before we find the devil being cast into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. I don't think there's any question but that the idea of the lake that burns with fire and brimstone is the end result, tormented forever and ever, right? And so you would expect that when the persecution is overcome and Rome falls, and the emperor falls, and the false prophet falls, that the devil is still there. And we're going to see some different things said about the devil at different times in chapter 20. I anticipate taking at least two Wednesday nights on chapter 20. 2 weeks from tonight, I probably will deal with the subject of premillennialism. We have discussed that a little bit, but I want to discuss it in light of chapter 20. And whatever we don't get to tonight, we'll deal with the devil, with the thousand-year reign, with judgment, with the first resurrection, with the second death, and with Hades. Now, I have discussed Hades a little bit, but I think we probably need to come back and give a little bit more thorough discussion on these parts of this area. You might think of the book of Revelation as the first three chapters being fairly easy to read and discuss, and the last two and a half chapters fairly easy to read and discuss. Now, when we get into the discussion of heaven and the victory that's there, I think we can understand how that applies to us. The hard part of Revelation is chapter 4 through the first part of chapter 20. We have been through that with the opening of the seven seals, the sounding of the seven trumpets, and the pouring out of the seven vials. And this seems to be almost a renaming of the whole situation, but in stronger terms with each of those. And then coming to the 17th and 18th and 19th chapters, with the final part of it, you remember where it said there in chapter 16, verse 17, after the seventh angel had poured out the seventh vial, saying, "It is done." In other words, this is the completion of what's being talked about throughout the book. And then when we get the false prophet taken care of and the beast taken care of, and when we get the devil under control, we've gone through the hard part of it. Now, one thing that I want you to remember about chapter 20 is that this is the only place in the entire Bible where the thousand-year reign is mentioned. I would guess that 90% of the preachers that you may have seen appear on television of different types and backgrounds believe in some form of the millennium. And I don't know whether you realize this or not, but the majority of the religious organizations in this town believe in some form of the millennium. They believe that Christ is coming back to this earth and set up some kind of an earthly kingdom. You just listen to what they're saying. Did you ever hear Jerry Falwell preach? I believe Jerry Falwell is associated with the Baptist, isn't he? And he was definitely, or is definitely, a premillennialist. I mentioned Hagee. You may have seen or heard him. And he is dyed-in-the-wool millennialist. And we will talk about premillennialism, and we will talk about postmillennialism, and maybe some other terms when we get to that. But as widespread as that doctrine is, that Christ is going to reign for 1,000 years on this earth, there is no other place in the entire Bible where a 1,000-year reign is mentioned except here. Now, they will connect it to some passages in maybe Daniel, maybe Ezekiel and others, but that's their connection to these things that are back there. Nowhere in the Old Testament is the reign of 1,000 years mentioned. And so this chapter is very important in that sense. I want us to look at the chapter in general, but before I do that, I want to point out something. There are those who think that the 20th, 21st, and 22nd chapter of the book of Revelation give us a continuation of what's in these previous chapters, and that this has its basic fulfillment with the seven churches of Asia and at that particular time. In fact, this book that I've referred you to, or that I've read from, that's put out by Weldon Warnock, he tends to take that position. But most of the ones, I think, that you would read after believe that from the middle of the 20th chapter through the 22nd chapter is talking about the end of time, talking about the final judgment, and then heaven and hell. I tend to believe that both of them are involved. Let me give you an example. Remember back in Isaiah 7:14 that there's the prediction about a virgin shall be with child and bring forth a son. That's basically a young woman at that time that was this was going to happen. He says that some of the things during the generation and maybe the next generation, these things were going to unfold before this woman bears this child. But then it has the prediction of Christ, doesn't it? It seems to have had a primary meaning to those people at that time, and then was giving the prediction of Christ coming. I feel like that what's in the 20th, 21st, and 22nd chapter may have had a particular meaning to those people that were living at that time. For example, when he says there will be a new heaven and a new earth, a new Jerusalem. He said he saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. And those who make that the primary approach say that heaven couldn't come out of heaven. But I believe he's still giving us the figure of speech and still using this apocalyptic type language to some extent, although not as much in these last few chapters. So I am willing to admit and to agree that those that were reading this when they got the letter, you remember we've emphasized looking at it through first century eyes, that it may have had a special meaning to them, fulfilled when Rome fell and then they were not persecuted like they had been. But I think from our standpoint today, when we get to the 11th verse of the 20th chapter, I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it. We immediately think of what when we think about the great white throne and him that sat on it? Judgment, don't we? God in judgment. And I think that from there on that we need to look at it like that. Now, having said that, let's read the 20th chapter. I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. Now, that verse is important particularly on this point. If the 1,000 years in verse 4 is literal, wouldn't you almost have to accept the bottomless pit and the chain as literal? And I don't think any of us would want to do that. The bottomless pit is used as a figure of speech to sort of refer to what's called the abyss or what's called that which is unseen. And you remember back in, was it Psalm 139, David said, if I ascend into heaven, thou art there. If I make my abode in the earth, in the depths of the earth, thou art there. It's used sort of as a figure of speech like that. So the angel came down with the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Well, again, I say if the 1,000 years is literal there, then it'd be a literal angel with a chain and a literal bottomless pit. That doesn't seem to be possible. Cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. Okay, the devil has been running roughshod through the Roman Empire and others persecuting the church. And now the beast is fallen, the city's fallen, the emperor's fallen, false prophet, those two are cast into the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone. That's the end of them. And so the dragon, who had been deceiving the nations, he's not going to be able to deceive them because the way in which he was deceiving them is no longer there when Rome falls. And so he says that he'll deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Now, The 1,000 years in verse 2 seems to be the same 1,000 years in verse 4. 1,000 years is used in the Bible in a figure of speech, usually to refer to a rather lengthy time, but a limited time, not specifically 1,000 years. You remember in this series of lessons that I'm using on Sunday morning that we talked about the cattle on 1,000 hills? And we were talking about that. I emphasized that he doesn't mean that just the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to God, but what cattle? All cattle. The completeness of a period of time there. You remember the passage, it says, with God, a day is as 1,000 years and a 1,000 years as a day. I heard a little funny story about that. Said this fellow went up to the pearly gates and asked Peter, who's always the one that keeps the pearly gates in all these stories, you remember. Said, how do you measure time up here? He said, oh, said, 1,000 years with God is as a day. He said, how do you measure time? Yeah, he said, even 1,000 years with God is like a minute. He said, how do you measure money? He said, $1,000 is as a penny. He said, would you loan me a penny? He said, I will in a minute. Now, I don't know what that has to do with the lesson, Charlie, but it came to mind, and I at least accomplished what I thought it would. It brought life. Okay, we're going to study this part of chapter 20 in the next lesson that we have. But I want to point out one or two things. The word they that's just before lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years, what part of speech is that? It's a pronoun, isn't it? You remember enough out of English to know if you've got a pronoun, what have you got to have to understand that pronoun? And that's called an antecedent. You remember that? If I just walked in the house and said, they are out in the yard, what would you know? You wouldn't know who they are, would you? But if I came in and said, the bushes are out in the yard and they are in the truck, then they would refer back to the bushes, right? What is the antecedent of they in that verse? This is a very, very important point. It doesn't say in this that we shall live and reign with Christ 1,000 years. It said they. And it's lived, that's in not living today. What is it? You got it. The word souls is the noun to which they refers. But what particular souls? The souls that were beheaded. Now you can diagram that verse, you can cut it up any way you want to, and you can't keep they from referring to the souls that were beheaded. So who is reigning with Christ 1,000 years? Whatever the 1,000 years is, whatever the reign is, it's the souls that were beheaded. And in preparation for our study of that, I want you to go back, I believe it's the 6th chapter that says the souls of the martyrs were under the throne. You remember that? And they asked what? How long? They were asking how long until our deaths will be avenged. And he said, wait a little longer. There's still some others that have to be martyred like you are. But eventually there's going to come the time of vengeance. Now, keep that in mind as you study chapter 20. And also one thing that we're going to show in the next one, and I'll give you a little hint on this. Think about what would be necessary for there to be a physical reign of Jesus on the throne, on David's throne in Jerusalem. For example, back in Daniel, it's predicted that in the days of these kings shall he set up a kingdom. And it's clearly understood that these kings were the Roman kings. Well, now that the Roman Empire is not in existence in this way anymore, if there's going to be a literal reign and it's going to be in the days of the kings of the in the days of the Roman kings, what have we got to happen before that thousand-year reign could begin? And if it has to do with the temple, and most of these will say that, that Jesus will reign in connection with the temple, what about the temple right now? It's in ruins, isn't it? We have a model of it in that area, but will the temple be rebuilt? Will the Roman Empire come back into existence? These are some things to keep in mind when we discuss the thousand-year reign. They lived with Christ 1,000 years, but the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. The souls that were beheaded are the ones that are going to be involved in this 1,000-year reign. What about the rest of the dead? They're not involved in that. And he goes ahead and says, this is the first resurrection. There's going to be another resurrection, but this is the first resurrection. There's going to be a resurrection when what number of people will be resurrected? Everybody. The hour is coming in which they that are in the grave shall hear his voice and come forth, they that have done good and they that have done evil. What's going to happen at the end of time? Everybody. Christ returns, Matthew 25 and 1 Corinthians 15, and all nations shall be gathered before him, and he'll separate them as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. But in this resurrection, whatever is referred to in this resurrection, who are the ones that are part of this first resurrection? The souls that were beheaded. The souls that were beheaded. So who, if you want to be a part of that thousand-year reign, what would you have to do? Be beheaded. Some interesting thoughts in connection with this. Then verse 6 says, blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection, on such the second death hath no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. I listened to Jeff's presentation last Wednesday night. Jeff's doing a good job in preparing and presenting these lessons. He made an observation in connection with the first resurrection and the second resurrection. You remember that? He made an observation that when we're baptized into Christ, there is what? A resurrection. And what he said was true in that he said we're resurrected at becoming a Christian, and if we continue faithfully in living the Christian life, then we will not be cast into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, right? That statement is true, but the premise that he started with, that it is that resurrection, cannot fit into this, because there's only a part of the Christians that are involved in this first resurrection. And all Christians are resurrected from baptism to walk in newness of life, aren't they? And also, if that first resurrection refers to becoming a Christian, that would be the best argument that you could find for once saved, always saved. Because if those of the first resurrection are those that have become Christians, he says, on them the second death hath no power. That would be proof without any question that you couldn't lose your salvation after you once become a Christian, no matter how you live. Again, the observation that there is a resurrection at the time we obey the gospel is true. And the way Jeff presented it is if we become Christians and remain faithful, he added that, then we would not have the second death, right? But the first resurrection here is the resurrection of these souls that were beheaded. And I believe it is a figurative resurrection. Let me use an example, if I can, that I think will help put it in focus. there are literally millions of Christians who already died, right? But there have been several Christians down through the years that have suffered in specific ways and maybe gave their lives or sacrificed a lot for the cause of Christ. And we tend to remember those, don't we? And not remember the others. You take the Restoration Movement, for example. What two men do you remember most about the Restoration Movement? Alexander and Thomas Campbell. They were not the first ones involved in the Restoration Movement. There were others maybe who sacrificed more than they did. Many others died during that time, but we tend to remember. I would guess if you took your own family, aren't there some people in your family who have passed on that you tend to remember more than other people in your family who have passed on? And maybe there's one or two in your family that you feel like are the people that caused your family to be where it is today and brought you to where you are today. And in your mind, at least, you pay tribute to them for what they did, right? They're not resurrected and brought back to you personally, but in your thinking, are they resurrected? I think that's exactly what is the situation here. What had been the general outlook toward those that had been beheaded? People in general would have thought, well, those are the ones that lost. They're the losers. But now when Rome is overcome, what happens to those that were beheaded? They become the winners. And as winners, they reign with Christ. I'll give you another example. Do we not almost think in the same breath or the same thought with Christ about the 12 apostles? Were the 12 apostles any more important than we are? Not really. But what did they do? They had a special work, didn't they? Now, isn't there a sense today in which we, not on the level with Christ, but wouldn't we sort of think of the 12 apostles as reigning with Christ in our memories, being respected along with Christ in our memories? I think that's exactly what this first resurrection is. That these people, Jeff also mentioned one last week at Smyrna called Polycarp. You remember that one? And is it Antipas that's mentioned in Revelation that was martyred? But Polycarp is one that, and he gave you the quote that was basically, as I understand it, what he said, 80 and 3 years, or I may have the number wrong there, I have lived and Christ has never deserted me and I will not desert him now. That's supposed to have been the quote that he made as he was being put to death. Well, just the fact that I mentioned Polycarp, there are a lot of others that died as Christians at that time, but why do we remember Polycarp? Because of that outstanding stand that he took for Christ. And when we mention Christianity today, in my own life, there have been some special people who've meant a lot to me in living the Christian life. Wouldn't you say that? Do not those people, in a sense, reign in your memory? Not on the level with Christ, but they reign because of what they've done for you. And so I think that's exactly what he's saying here. And the second death that's talked about here has no power. Look at Revelation 21 and verse 8 for just a moment. You've heard this verse quoted many, many times. Fearful, unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, whoremongers, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Now, if there's a second death, there's got to be what? A first death. Well, let me throw this out to you. It's important to remember that the word death literally means separation. When God told Adam and Eve not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. What did he do? He put them out of the garden. and fixed it where they couldn't be in that same presence with God that they'd had. They were separated from God, weren't they? They died in that sense that day. Now, did that have an effect on bringing about physical death? Yes. Did it have an effect on bringing about spiritual death? Yes. But there was a death at that point. Paul said in Philippians 1, I die daily. What do you mean by that? As a Christian, I may suffer or sacrifice daily. There's a death. You remember that passage in, is it 1 Timothy 5 that's talking about the woman that's like a busybody and says, it says the statement, she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. If we give ourselves over just to live in pleasure, God says that's a type of death, isn't it? Because if we're living in sin and pleasure and stay in that, are we separated from God? So you've got many deaths. I think the first death in connection with the second death has to be the physical death. Hebrews 9:27, quote that, it is appointed unto man, what word does he use? Once to die. Now, I think the once is used there in the sense of one time, but that suggests the idea of a first, doesn't it? And now we have the second death. And what he is saying here in this relative to the first resurrection and the second death is this. These people who were beheaded as martyrs died as faithful Christians. They were under the throne of God. Now they're going to reign with Christ in that their work is vindicated and their death is avenged. And if they have already died and are considered to be under the throne of God, then is that salvation guaranteed? It's already indicated, isn't it? So if it's guaranteed, then on them the second death what? Has no power. They're not going to go into the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, where the false prophet and the beast have just gone and where the devil is about to go. They're not going to be touched by the second death because they are already, you remember 14:13, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord. From henceforth they shall rest from their labor. If you die in the Lord, what's guaranteed? Heaven. And if heaven is guaranteed, then the second death's not going to have any power on you. So I think that's it, is exactly what is involved here with the first resurrection and the second death. And we may discuss that a little bit more. When 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. He ain't dead yet. And shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog. That's two words from Ezekiel of people who fought against God's people, Israel, at that time, used in a figure of speech here. To gather them together to battle, the number of whom is the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. I can't get anything out of that except the end of time. When will the torment forever and ever begin? At the judgment day. And how long will the devil be trying to work against God? As long as this earth stands, right? Now, I want you to look at the devil in three passages. Verse 2, he was bound 1,000 years. In verse 3, he's loosed a little season. And in verse 10, he's cast into the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone and tormented forever and ever. That gives you a pretty good picture of the devil. And put it in connection with our study of Revelation. During this time of severe persecution, what was the devil doing? Running roughshod, not bound, right? Seemed like he could do anything he wanted to. What happens as the Roman Empire falls? The devil is bound. How long? for a season. Things much better. Then later on, what happens? He's loosed. And then the end result is he's going to be burned in the lake, or live in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone forever. And would you not agree that even in your lifetime there have been times that the devil seemed to be loose, and other times that things were better and he seems to have been bound a bit? I think that's the picture here. The devil had been through the Roman Empire persecuting the church full force, and now, as God has promised, they overcome. And the devil is bound. He's not doing that now because the false prophet and the beast, for one thing, are gone. He doesn't have that particular means. And he's going to be bound for a little while, but then what's he going to be? He'll come back again. And if you look at history, have there been times that evil has been worse than at other times? And I'll not ask you what time you think we're in right now. But I think that's exactly what he's saying here. And then beginning at verse 11, we see the great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. Now, back in the thousand-year reign, it's just the souls that were beheaded. But what about the dead now? We're beginning to go into a passage that says everybody's going to be there. The books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. The sea gave up the dead which was in it, and death and hell. And that word should be Hades. You may be reading from a version that has Hades in it. There are three words that are translated hell in the King James Version. And usually when we see the word hell, we think of the eternal hell, don't we? But this is not. This is Hades. Delivered up the dead that were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Now, here are some questions that will come up as we study this section. Notice there were books opened. That's plural. And then there another book was opened. That's singular. What are the books? What's the book? It tells us what the book is. It's the book of life. And their names were written in it. We know what that is. It tells us in general what the books were. The standard of judgment. That which was used as the standard for the judgment. They were judged out of the things written in the books according to their works. What's that referring to exactly? Then death and Hades deliver up the dead that's in them. Interesting question. The story of the rich man and Lazarus, was the rich man already suffering? Was Lazarus already at peace? If during this Hadean world there's already the separation, why does there need to be a judgment? Interesting. You're safe on that statement, aren't you? God said there would be. That's pretty good reason. But where do we go when we die? You hear most people say he died and went straight to heaven, right? I don't believe that's what the Bible teaches. You go into paradise is involved in this Hadean world, right? There's another word, Tartarus, or Tartarus, that's involved in that. Now, I've raised enough questions tonight that we won't have more than one lesson I can already see on this. But aren't these some of the things that you think about and have questions about? And I don't have all the answers, but I think I can give you some things that will be helpful on that. So next time, we will study the thousand-year reign. We'll study the Hadean world, what happens after death. And we'll study the judgment scene. I think we have seen basically what happens with the devil, haven't we? Is the devil alive today? Yes. Has he been loosed again? I think so in some ways. but what will be the end result eventually. So you've gotten a picture of the 20th chapter. Now when we get into the 21st and 22nd chapter, that's going to be more positive, isn't it, of the things toward which we can look. But I wanted to set the stage tonight, and here are the things that we've been talking about: the devil, the rain, first resurrection, the judgment, second death, 1,000 years, Hades, and we will discuss all of those to some extent in the next week or two. I'm shooting for finishing the book of Revelation at the end of June. I have 2 Wednesday nights with you in May and 2 in June. I've got 4 more Wednesday nights to do that. I want to spend 1 Wednesday night on the 21st chapter and 1 on the 22nd chapter. But I anticipate that we will probably spend 2 more Wednesday nights, seeing where we got tonight, dealing with these subjects that we've just brought up. Are these subjects you'd like to discuss? Okay. I'm going to take a chance. Any questions? The Antichrist. John mentions the Antichrist in 1 John. And maybe other places that it's mentioned. In fact, isn't there a prediction, and I'll have to see exactly where this is, that some of these things will not happen until the Antichrist come? And we'll deal with that. I don't think it's particularly in connection with this passage as such, maybe in connection with premillennialism, but they do. I'll make a note of that, and right. I'll make a note of that and look up those passages, and we will discuss that. Anything else? Well, I said that the hard part is through the middle of 20th chapter, and we've only got about 7 more subjects to cover now until we get through that, and then we'll be in the easy part. I think when we're through that you will know a little more of what's in Revelation, whether you understand it or not. Am I safe in saying that? Okay. If you get to where you understand it completely, I'd like to sit down with you for a few hours and listen.